Come Closer by Sarah Gran isn't just another horror novel. It's a psychological masterpiece that has haunted readers since its publication in 2003. This slim volume has become a cult classic, with Stephen King calling it one of the most frightening books I've ever read, and Gillian Flynn citing it as inspiration for her psychological thrillers. What makes this book particularly unsettling is how it blurs the line between mental illness and supernatural possession, making readers question their own inexplicable behaviors. When Taylor Swift mentioned it in a 2018 interview as the book that kept me up for a week, sales skyrocketed, again, proving its enduring power to disturb. What begins as a subtle psychological thriller transforms into a terrifying descent into possession that will have you questioning every unexplained sound in your home and every inexplicable impulse in your mind. It begins innocently enough, a mysterious tapping sound in Amanda and Ed's converted loft apartment. Located in an isolated industrial neighborhood inside a century-old aspirin factory, the space should feel like a sanctuary. Amanda, an architect who designed the renovation herself, initially loves their home despite the desolate surroundings. The building's history fascinates her. Its brick walls have witnessed decades of industrial progress, and its soaring windows flood the space with natural light. But something isn't right. The tapping follows a peculiar pattern. It stops when Amanda travels, but persists relentlessly when she's home alone. At first, it's just three distinct taps, always around midnight, emanating from somewhere within the walls. Over weeks, the pattern grows more complex, almost like Morse code, a thought that keeps Amanda awake at night. The first truly alarming incident occurs at Amanda's workplace, a prestigious architectural firm where she's been rising steadily for 5 years. She discovers someone has replaced her proposal to her boss Leon with an obscene note filled with vulgar insults. Though three colleagues, Sarah from accounting, Mike from design, and her assistant Jenny, claim they saw her deliver it, Amanda has no memory of writing such a thing. What disturbs her most is that the insults perfectly match her private feelings about Leon, thoughts she's never shared with anyone, not even in her personal journal. The note describes his habit of taking credit for others' work and his condescending attitude toward female employees, observations Amanda has silently noted for years. These early disruptions seem minor, perhaps pipes settling in an old building, a momentary lapse in judgment at work. We all experience such things, don't we? But Amanda's life begins unraveling in subtle ways. She and Ed start arguing more frequently, particularly about time. She's certain he's coming home later than he claims, while he insists she's losing track of hours. Their once stable relationship develops hairline fractures. Small items begin disappearing from their apartment, her favorite coffee mug, then her grandmother's silver locket. A stray German shepherd that used to follow Amanda home affectionately suddenly grows wary of her, backing away with raised hackles, sensing something others cannot yet see. What makes this progression so chilling is its gradualness. There's no dramatic moment when everything changes, just a slow accumulation of oddities that could individually be dismissed as coincidence. Amanda finds herself double-checking locked doors, recording conversations on her phone, and taking photos of documents she sends. This mirrors how we often ignore warning signs in our own lives, attributing unexplainable events to stress or fatigue rather than acknowledging something fundamental might be changing within us. The human mind's remarkable ability to normalize the abnormal becomes both a survival mechanism and a trap. By the time we recognize the pattern, it may already be too late, like watching a photograph develop in reverse, clarity fading into darkness. Amanda's dreams become the gateway through which something ancient and malevolent begins to enter her life. She dreams of a beautiful woman with matted black hair named Nama, standing in a crimson ocean with red sand. They embrace like sisters, with an intensity that feels both familiar and frightening. Upon waking, Amanda realizes Nama bears a striking resemblance to Pansy, her childhood imaginary friend who mysteriously appeared to her when she was 9 years old. When Amanda shares this connection with Ed, he dismisses her experience, suggesting Pansy was just Tracy Berkowitz, a neighborhood girl. Despite Amanda's certainty about the connection between Pansy and Nama, she lets it go, agreeing with Ed that they both need to relax. This moment represents the first critical failure, the dismissal of intuition in favor of rational explanation. The dreams continue, growing more vivid and intrusive. In one particularly disturbing encounter, Amanda sees a woman with small white feet and bright black eyes who whispers, "Don't fight," and "I choose you," before pulling Amanda into a tight, suffocating embrace. Strangely, after this dream, the tapping noise in the apartment disappears completely. The silence should be a relief, but instead feels ominous, as though whatever was trying to get in has finally succeeded. As the dreams intensify, Amanda's waking life begins to blur. She experiences moments of dissociation where she's watching herself from outside her body. A new voice emerges in her mind, almost like her own, but subtly different, encouraging impulsive behaviors without consideration of consequences. This voice doesn't feel like a mental illness. It feels like companionship, like someone whispering directly into her thoughts. These altered states mirror how trauma or significant life changes can fragment our sense of self. We sometimes feel like observers in our own lives, disconnected from our actions. What makes Amanda's situation terrifying is that this fragmentation isn't coming from within. It's being orchestrated by something that wants to wear her life like a costume, gradually pushing her consciousness aside to make room for itself. The supernatural element of Amanda's experience crystallizes when she receives a book mistakenly delivered to her doorstep, Demon Possession, Past and Present, instead of the design book she ordered. The mix-up itself seems almost orchestrated, as if some unseen force engineered this accident. Out of boredom, while waiting for Ed's return, she begins leafing through its pages, eventually discovering a quiz titled "Are You Possessed by a Demon?", which methodically lists 10 warning signs of demonic possession. The questions range from seemingly innocuous phenomena, like hearing unexplained noises that only occur in your presence, to deeply disturbing urges toward violence and self-harm. The quiz's warning signs become increasingly specific and unsettling, experiencing time loss, speaking in languages you've never studied, objects moving without explanation, and overwhelming urges to harm loved ones. Each question feels more invasive than the last, probing deeper into the darkness of human experience. Amanda's initial skepticism gives way to growing unease as she recognizes her own experiences in the clinical descriptions. After taking the quiz, Amanda scores a 4 out of 10, placing her in the early stages of possession category. The clinical tone of the questionnaire creates a disturbing juxtaposition, something as irrational and ancient as demonic possession presented through the modern, rational framework of a diagnostic tool. It's like finding a medical checklist for determining if you're turning into a werewolf, complete with checkbox symptoms and risk categories. As Amanda's behavior grows increasingly erratic, she finds herself drawn back to the quiz repeatedly, compulsively retaking it as new symptoms emerge. She watches her score climb from 4 to 5, marking each new manifestation with scientific precision. Levitation during sleep, unexplained marks on her body, violent outbursts she can't remember. When her score finally reaches 7, placing her in the highest risk category, "You are possessed, consult with your spiritual counselor immediately," the clinical language only amplifies the horror of her situation. What makes this element of the story so effective is how it mirrors our modern tendency to self-diagnose through internet quizzes and symptom checkers. We obsessively Google our symptoms, seeking validation for our fears and frameworks to understand our experiences. The quiz taps into this contemporary behavior while subverting it. Instead of finding reassurance, Amanda finds confirmation of her worst nightmares. The familiar format of a diagnostic tool makes the supernatural elements feel more real, more immediate, and ultimately more terrifying. The quiz becomes Amanda's touchstone, an objective measure of something subjectively horrifying. Each increasing score represents another piece of her autonomy slipping away, another part of her consciousness being colonized by Nama. The progression from 4 to 7 marks not just an escalation of symptoms, but a countdown to complete possession. By the time she reaches 7, the question is no longer whether she's possessed, but whether there's any hope of fighting back against what's already taken hold. The quiz transforms from a curious diversion into a horror story told in checkboxes and point values, each new mark a step closer to complete dissolution of self. As Nama's presence grows stronger, Amanda develops increasingly disturbing supernatural abilities that fundamentally alter her perception of reality. When she touches people, she experiences visceral, overwhelming visions of their lives. Not just surface glimpses, but deep dives into their most private moments and hidden truths. Through a simple handshake with her local butcher, she witnesses years of his family dinners, arguments with his wife, and tender moments with his children. Her regular coffee vendor's cheerful demeanor masks a seething resentment. Amanda sees his nightly ritual of replaying customer interactions, muttering cruel responses he wishes he could voice. These abilities prove particularly potent when Amanda manipulates Linda Marcello, using intimate knowledge gained through an accidental brush of hands. She leverages details about Linda's deceased mother and childhood traumas, information she couldn't possibly know through normal means, to achieve her desired outcomes. The power fluctuates unpredictably throughout the summer months, sometimes flooding her with unwanted insights into strangers' lives, other times leaving her frustratingly normal, unable to access this sixth sense despite her attempts. What initially seems like a potential advantage becomes a crushing burden that deepens Amanda's isolation. The weight of carrying others' secrets and sorrows becomes unbearable, especially since she can't share these experiences with anyone. Her husband, Ed, ever the pragmatist, would dismiss such supernatural occurrences as delusions or mumbo-jumbo, creating yet another barrier in their increasingly strained relationship. The inability to process these experiences with others forces Amanda to shoulder this psychological burden alone. The progression toward violence begins subtly, but accelerates at an alarming rate. The cigarette incident with Ed marks a crucial turning point. While the physical damage is minimal, the implications are profound. Amanda describes the experience with chilling clarity, her arm moving with precise, deliberate intent, completely divorced from her conscious will. This wasn't a moment of absent-mindedness or poor judgment. It was the first concrete evidence that something else could hijack her motor functions. The beach incident represents a horrifying escalation in both scale and intent. Finding a young girl swimming alone in deep water, Amanda's body moves with predatory purpose. She grabs the child's hair, repeatedly forcing her underwater with calculated malice. The girl's terrified screams only cease when Amanda fabricates a story about an undertow, playing the role of concerned adult as a bystander arrives. Though the child survives, Amanda's crystal-clear awareness during the attack haunts her. She knew exactly what she was doing and couldn't stop herself. These episodes are particularly terrifying because Amanda remains fully conscious throughout. Unlike traditional possession narratives where the host blacks out, Amanda experiences every moment with excruciating clarity. She's essentially imprisoned within her own body, forced to watch as her hands and limbs move against her will, performing actions that horrify her moral sensibilities. This creates a uniquely intimate form of psychological torture, being both perpetrator and unwilling witness to increasingly violent acts, unable to prevent them despite desperate internal resistance. The violation of bodily autonomy becomes complete, creating a horror more profound than any external threat could achieve. As her condition deteriorates, Amanda attempts to find help through various channels, each representing different approaches to understanding human suffering. First, she visits Dr. Flynn, who runs extensive tests and questioning about her strange symptoms, ultimately diagnosing low blood pressure and recommending more salt. This medical approach, focused on physical symptoms while missing the supernatural reality, represents science's limitations when confronting phenomena outside its paradigm. Next, Amanda visits Sister Maria, a spiritual advisor in a rundown neighborhood. Inside a back room with red velveteen walls, Sister Maria immediately senses a presence. Someone's watching you. She's right next to you. Beautiful, but black. Evil. Maria reveals it's a demon with long black hair and pointy teeth, not a person. She provides Amanda with a special wash labeled Number 5, Demon Fighting, and instructions for its use. This religious approach acknowledges the supernatural element, but offers only symbolic resistance rather than effective intervention. Finally, Amanda sees psychiatrist Dr. Gerald Finton, referred by Dr. Flynn. During their session, Amanda selectively describes her recent behavioral changes, omitting the most disturbing incidents. Dr. Fenton dismissively suggests she's simply coming into her own as an adult woman. When he reveals knowledge of incidents Amanda never mentioned and correctly states her age without being told, Amanda becomes alarmed. The psychiatric approach is revealed to be compromised. Either Dr. Fenton is incompetent or, more terrifyingly, complicit with the demonic forces affecting Amanda. Each attempt at help fails in its own way, creating a perfect storm of isolation. Medicine can't detect the problem, religion can't solve it, and psychiatry might actually be working against her. This represents the ultimate horror of Amanda's situation. There is nowhere left to turn, no institution capable of understanding or addressing what's happening to her. The failure of these systems mirrors real-world experiences of those suffering from complex conditions that don't fit neatly into established diagnostic categories. How many people have been told their very real suffering is just stress or all in your head? Amanda's journey through these failed attempts at help creates a profound loneliness that makes her increasingly vulnerable to Nayama's complete takeover. As Nama's influence grows stronger, Amanda's identity begins to fragment and dissolve in increasingly disturbing ways. The initial signs are subtle: small gaps in memory, moments of confusion, and a growing sense of disconnection from her usual routines. These episodes escalate into full blackouts and significant periods of lost time. Most frighteningly, she discovers a 2-hour void in her workday when she thought only 1 hour had passed. The horror intensifies when she learns that during this precise window, a notoriously rude magazine stand owner was brutally murdered, raising the terrifying possibility that she might have committed the crime while under Nama's influence. The physical manifestation of this internal transformation becomes increasingly apparent. Her facial features begin to shift subtly, her cheekbones seem higher, her eyes take on an unusual glint, and her smile becomes unfamiliar even to herself. An acquaintance at work comments on her altered appearance, noting that she looks different somehow, though they can't quite place what has changed. Amanda notices with growing dread that her appearance increasingly matches the historical descriptions of Nama from her research: pale skin taking on an alabaster quality, hair developing a distinctive sheen, and her movements becoming more fluid and predatory. Even animals sense the change. Her neighbor's German shepherd, who once bounded eagerly to greet her and gratefully accepted treats from her hand, now backs away with hackles raised. The dog's rejection is particularly poignant, a pure creature recognizing that the person it once knew has been fundamentally altered, replaced by something ancient and wrong. The identity dissolution reaches a disturbing climax at the Ermark Hotel reopening party. Though Amanda arrives with firm intentions to make a brief appearance and leave early, Nama's influence takes hold. She experiences complete dissociation as she finds herself drawn to Tom Ermark, watching helplessly as her body moves of its own accord. "I was watching it all, I could see it, but I wasn't inside of myself," she recalls later. In a dreamlike state that feels both viscerally real and utterly foreign, she follows him to the penthouse suite. The sexual encounter that follows is both passionate and horrifying. Amanda is simultaneously present and absent, observer and unwilling participant. When full awareness suddenly returns, the reality of what has occurred hits her with physical force. She flees the hotel, violently ill, vomiting in the street as her mind struggles to process the violation of her autonomy. What makes this identity dissolution particularly terrifying is Amanda's persistent awareness throughout the process. Rather than a clean replacement, she experiences a gradual erosion of self while maintaining enough consciousness to witness her own dissolution. She's forced to observe as Nama systematically dismantles her life, watching helplessly as her relationships crumble, her professional reputation unravels, and her moral boundaries dissolve. In rare moments of clarity, she recognizes the magnitude of these changes with horror, but Nama's seductive voice invariably returns, whispering that she's still herself, only better, more powerful, more alluring, more alive. This represents the ultimate identity horror, not just losing oneself, but being forced to remain conscious as a passenger in one's own life, watching as an ancient entity commandeers your existence. Like a prisoner in her own mind, Amanda observes as Nama wears her life like an ill-fitting costume, systematically destroying everything that once defined her, while she remains aware but powerless to intervene. The complete takeover happens gradually, then suddenly. Amanda's possession by Nama accelerates as their relationship deteriorates into cold formality. With Edward gone, Amanda's consciousness fractures into disconnected episodes, waking in strange places, burning Edward's clothes, trapping someone in the bathroom, vandalizing lingerie in stores. She encounters another possessed girl on a train who shares a black cloud that Nama eagerly consumes, suggesting a network of possession beyond Amanda's individual experience. In her dreams, Amanda returns repeatedly to the Crimson Beach, where Nama declares, "I love you, I'm never letting you go." This twisted declaration reveals Nama's motivation, not just destruction, but a perverse form of love and possession. She wants Amanda not merely as a vessel, but as a companion, trapped forever in supernatural bondage. During a snowstorm, Edward unexpectedly returns to the apartment, disheveled and crying. Amanda desperately wants to reminisce about their love and explain her situation, but Nama locks her throat closed. Edward reveals he's filing for divorce to remarry, and as Amanda mentally pleads to communicate, she falls into darkness where Nama writes in the sand, "I win." The narrative culminates in horror as Amanda awakens to find police in her apartment, blood everywhere, and "I win" painted on the bedroom wall in Edward's blood. She's institutionalized after pleading insanity, where Nama thrives, controlling other patients and staff. In rare moments of consciousness, Amanda tries to remember Edward, but can only see the blood-soaked bedroom. The final tragedy is that Nama has given Amanda exactly what she unconsciously desired: someone to love me and never leave me alone. This perverse fulfillment of Amanda's deepest wish, connection without abandonment, comes at the cost of her autonomy, her identity, and ultimately her humanity. The possession is complete, not just of her body, but of her very soul. In the end, what makes this story so profoundly disturbing isn't just the supernatural horror, but how it mirrors very real human experiences of losing oneself to addiction, to mental illness, to toxic relationships. We all fear being trapped inside ourselves, watching helplessly as something else controls our actions. Amanda's possession is the ultimate manifestation of that universal fear. The book concludes with a chilling postscript from fictional editors on the 20th anniversary of publication. They express profound regret over publishing this book, which has generated more confusion and fear about demonic possession than any other text. They receive constant letters from frightened readers seeking guidance on avoiding supernatural forces, suggesting the book itself might be a vector for spreading demonic influence. A troubling Q&A section follows, addressing readers concerned about possession. For those with high quiz scores, the editors advise constant self-examination and questioning of every impulse. When readers notice changes in loved ones' behavior, the editors warn this could be evil targeting happiness. Multiple questions about mysterious sounds in homes receive disturbing responses, including an editor's own obsessive search for a non-existent sparrow in their walls. This metafictional element extends the horror beyond the narrative itself, suggesting that merely reading about possession might make one vulnerable to it. the final, desperate, fragmented question receives only the ominous response, "We are looking for you. We are here to help." Until that day comes, you are in our prayers. This postscript transforms the book from a contained horror story into a potential contagion, something that might infect the reader through the very act of reading. It's a brilliant narrative device that extends the horror beyond the page and into the reader's life, making us question our own unexplained behaviors and mysterious sounds in our homes. The legacy of Come Closer isn't just its portrayal of possession, but how it makes us question the boundaries between mental illness and supernatural influence, between coincidence and malevolence, between our autonomous choices and influences we may not fully understand. In a world increasingly focused on rational explanations, it reminds us of ancient fears that still lurk in our collective unconscious, fears that perhaps exist for good reason. After all, as the Demon Quiz warns, if you scored between 4 to 5 positive answers, you may be in the early stages of possession. What was your score?